South Africa did not have a TV network, but Shaza had seen Heartbreak Ridge on BBC television during his last stay in London. It was a gritty, totally absorbing commentary on the Korean War, and Shaza found it hard to believe that this child had done that. She turned now and came directly to him, holding out her hand, frank and friendly, a fresh-faced ingenue. "Hello, Mr. Courtney, I'm Kitty Godolphin." She had an enchanting accent, and there were fine golden freckles across her cheeks and her small pert nose. But then he saw that she had good bone structure and interesting planes to her face that would render her highly photogenic. "Mr. Courtney," she said, "you speak so well I couldn't resist trying to get a little more out of you on film. I hope I haven't put you out too much." She smiled at him, a sweet, engaging smile. But he looked beyond it into eyes as hard as any diamonds from the Hani mine, eyes that were bright with a sharp, cynical intelligence and ruthless ambition. That was unexpected and intriguing. "Here's a show that'll be worth the entrance fee," he thought, and glanced down. Her breasts were small, smaller than he usually chose, but they were unsupported, and he could see their shape beneath her blouse. They were exquisite. She led him to the leather chairs she had arranged to face each other under the lights. "If you would sit on this side, we'll get right into it. I'll do my introduction later. I don't want to keep you any longer than I have to." "As long as you like." "Oh, I know that you have a room full of important guests." She glanced at her crew, and one of them gave her a thumbs up. She looked back at Shaza. "The American public knows very little about South Africa," she explained. "What I'm trying to do is capture a cross-section of your society and figure out how it all works. I'll introduce you as a politician, mining tycoon, and financier, and tell them about this fabulous new gold mine of yours. Then we'll cut to you, okay?" "Okay," he smiled easily. "Let her roll." The clapper loader snapped the board in front of Shaza's face. Somebody said, "Sound," and somebody else replied, "Rolling," and then, "Action." "Mr. Shaza Courtney, you have just told a meeting of your shareholders that your new gold mine will probably be one of the five richest in South Africa, which makes it one of the richest in the world. Can you tell our viewers just how much of that fabulous wealth will be going back to people from which it was stolen in the first place?" she asked with breathtaking candor. "And I am, of course, referring to the black tribes who once owned the land." Shaza was off balance for only the moment that it took him to realize that he was in a fight. Then he responded easily. "The black tribes who once owned the land on which the Silver River mine is situated were slaughtered to the last man, woman, and child back in the 1820s by the impis of Kings Shaka and Mzilikazi, those two benevolent Zulu monarchs who between them managed to reduce the population of southern Africa by 50%, he told her. "When the white settlers moved northwards, they came upon a land denuded of all human life. The land they staked was open. They stole it from nobody. I bought the mineral rights from people who had clear, undisputed title to it." He saw a glint of respect in her eyes, but she was as quick as he had been. She had lost a point, but she was ready to play the next. "Historical facts are interesting, of course, but let's return to the present. Tell me, if you had been a man of color, Mr. Courtney, say black or an Asiatic businessman, would you have been allowed to purchase the concessions to the Silver River mine?" "That's a hypothetical question, Miss Godolphin." "I don't think so." She cut off his escape. "Am I wrong in thinking that the Group Areas Act, recently promulgated by the Parliament, of which you are a sitting member, prevents non-white individuals and companies owned by blacks from purchasing land or mineral rights anywhere in their own land?" "I voted against that legislation," Shaza said grimly. "But yes, the Group Areas Act would have prevented a colored person acquiring the rights in the Silver River mine," he conceded. Too clever to labor a point well taken, she moved on swiftly. "How many black people does the Courtney Mining and Finance Company employ in its numerous enterprises?" she asked with that sweet open smile. "Altogether, through 18 subsidiary companies, we provide work for some 2,000 whites and 30,000 blacks." "That is a marvelous achievement, and must make you very proud, Mr. Courtney." She was breathlessly girlish. "And how many blacks do you have sitting on the boards of those 18 companies?" Again, he had been wrong-footed, and he avoided the question. "We make a point of paying well above the going rate for the job, and the other benefits we provide to our employees. Kitty nodded brightly, letting him finish, quite happy that she could edit out all this extraneous material. But the moment he paused, she came in again. So there are no black directors on the Courtney Company boards. Can you tell us how many black departmental managers you have appointed? Once, long ago, hunting buffalo in the forests along the Zambezi River, Shaza had been attacked by a heat-maddened swarm of the big black African honeybees. There had been no defense against them, and he had only escaped at last by diving into the crocodile-infested Zambezi River. He felt that same sense of angry helplessness now, as she buzzed around his head, effortlessly avoiding his attempts to swat her down and darting out to sting painfully, almost at will. 30,000 black men working for you and not a single director or manager amongst them? She marveled ingenuously. Can you suggest why that might be? We have a predominantly tribal rural black society in this country, and they come to the cities unskilled and untrained. Oh, don't you have training programs? Shaza accepted the opening. The Courtney Group has a massive training program. Last year alone, we spent £2.5 million on employee education and job training. How long has this program been in operation, Mr. Courtney? 7 years, ever since I became chairman. And in 7 years, after all that money spent on education, not one black of all those thousands has been promoted to managerial status? Is that because you have not found a single capable black? Or is it because your job reservation policy and your strict color bar prevent any black, no matter how good? He was driven back inexorably, until in anger he went on the offensive. If you were looking for racial discrimination, why didn't you stay in America? He asked her, smiling icily. I'm sure your own Martin Luther King would be able to help you more than I can. There is a bigotry in my country, she nodded. We understand that, and we are changing it, educating our people and outlawing its practice. But from what I have seen, you are indoctrinating your children in this policy you call apartheid, and enshrining it in a monumental fortress of laws like your Group Areas Act and your Population Registration Act, which seeks to classify all men by the color of their skin alone. We differentiate, Shaza conceded, but that does not mean that we discriminate. That's a catchy slogan, Mr. Courtney, but not original. I have already heard it from your Minister of Bantu Affairs, Dr. Hendrik French Verwoerd. However, I suggest to you that you do discriminate. If a man is denied the right to vote or to own land merely because his skin is dark, that, in my book, is discrimination. And before he could respond, she had switched again. How many black people do you number amongst your personal friends? She asked engagingly. And the question transported Shaza instantly back across the years. He remembered as a lad standing his first shifts on the Hani mine and the man who had been his friend. The black boss boy in charge of the weathering grounds on which the newly mined blue ore from the pit was laid out to soften and crumble to the point at which it could be carted to the mill. He hadn't thought about him for years, yet he remembered his name without effort. Moses Gama. And he saw him in his mind's eye, tall and broad-shouldered, handsome as a young pharaoh, with skin that glowed like old amber in the sunlight as they toiled side by side. He remembered their long, rambling discussions, how they had read and argued together, drawn together by some unusual bond of the spirit. Shaza had lent him Macaulay's History of England, and when Moses Gama was fired from the Hani mine on the instigation of Santan Courtney as a direct result of the unacceptably intimate friendship between them, Shaza had asked him to keep the book. Now he felt again a faint echo of the sense of deprivation he had experienced at the time of their enforced parting. "I have only a handful of personal friends," he told her now. 10,000 acquaintances, but only a very few friends. He held up the fingers of his right hand. No more than that, and none of them happened to be black. Though once I had a black man as a friend, and I grieved when our ways parted. With the sure instinct which made her supreme in her craft, Kitty Godolphin recognized that he had given her a perfect peg on which to hang the interview. Once I had a black man as a friend, she repeated softly, and I grieved when our ways parted. Thank you, Mr. Courtney. She turned to her cameraman. Okay, Hank, cut it and get the studio to print it tonight. She stood up quickly, and Shaza towered over her. That was excellent. There is a great deal of material there we can use, she enthused. I'm really grateful for your cooperation. Smiling urbanely, Shaza leaned close to her. You are a devious little bitch, aren't you? He said softly. A face like an angel and a heart of hell. You know, it isn't like you made it sound. And you don't care. As long as you get a good story, you don't give a damn whether it's true or not, or who it hurts, do you? Shaza turned from her and strode out of the boardroom. The floor show had started, and he went to the table at which Santan and Blaine Malcolm-S were sitting. But the night had been spoiled for him. He sat and glowered at the swirling dancers, not really seeing their long naked limbs and gleaming flesh, but thinking furiously of Kitty Godolphin instead. Danger excited him. That was why he hunted lion and buffalo, and flew his own tiger moth, and played polo. Kitty Godolphin was dangerous. He was always attracted to intelligent and competent women with strong personalities. And this one was devastatingly competent and made of pure silk and steel. He thought about that lovely innocent face and childlike smile and the hard gleam of her eyes, and his fury was compounded by his desire to subjugate her emotionally and physically, and the fact that he knew it would be difficult made the thought all the more obsessive. He found that he was physically aroused, and that increased his anger. He glanced up suddenly, and from across the room, Jill Anstey, the public relations director, was watching him. The coloured lights played on the Slavic planes of her face and glinted on the platinum sheet of her hair. She slanted her eyes at him and ran the tip of her tongue over her lower lip. All right, he thought. I have to take it out on somebody, and you will do. He inclined his head slightly, and Jill Anstey nodded and slipped out of the door behind her. Shaza murmured an apology to Santon, then stood up and moved through the pounding music and semi-darkness towards the door through which Jill Anstey had disappeared. Shaza got back to the Carlton Hotel at 9 o'clock in the morning. Still in black tie and dinner jacket, he avoided the lobby and went up the back stairs from the underground garage. Santan and Blaine were in the company suite, and Shaza had the smaller suite across the passage. He dreaded meeting either of them dressed as he was at this time of the morning. But he was lucky and got into his lounge uninterrupted. Somebody had slipped an envelope under his door, and he picked it up without particular interest, until he saw the Killarney Film Studio's crest on the flap. Kitty Godolphin was working out of that studio, and he grinned and split the flap with his thumbnail. "Dear Mr. Courtney, the rushes are just great. You look better than Errol Flynn on film. If you want to see them, call me at the studio. Kitty Godolphin." His anger had cooled, and he was amused by her cheek, and though he had a full day ahead, lunch with Lord Lyttelton and meetings all afternoon, he phoned the studio. "Ah, you just caught me," Kitty told him. "I was on my way out. You want to see the rushes? Okay, can you get up here at 6 this evening?" She was smiling that sweet childlike smile and mocking him with a malicious green sparkle in her eyes as she came down to the reception desk of the studio to shake his hand and lead him to her hired projection room in the complex. "I knew I could rely on your masculine vanity to get you up here," she assured him. Her film crew was sprawled untidily over the front row of seats in the projection room, smoking Camels and drinking Cokes. But Hank, the cameraman, had the film clip in the projector ready to run, and they watched it through in silence. When the lights went up again, Shaza turned to Kitty and conceded. "You are good. You made me look a real prick most of the time, and of course you can always lose the parts where I held my own on the cutting room floor." "You don't like it?" she grinned, wrinkling her small nose so the freckles on it gleamed like tiny gold coins. "You're a bushwhacker, shooting from cover, and I'm out there with my back wide open." "If you accuse me of faking it," she challenged him, "how about you taking me and showing me the way it really is? Show me the Courtney mines and factories and let me film them." So that was why she had called him. He smiled to himself, but asked, "Have you got 10 days? "I've got as long as it takes," she assured him. "All right, let's start with dinner tonight." "Great," she enthused, and then turned to her crew. "Mazel tov, boys. Mr. Courtney is standing us all to dinner." "That's not exactly what I had in mind," he murmured. "Do tell," she gave him her innocent little girl look. Kitty Godolphin was a rewarding companion. Her interest in everything he said or showed her was flattering and unfeigned. She watched his eyes or his lips as he spoke, and often leaned so close to listen that he could feel her breath on his face, but she never actually touched him. For Shasa, her appeal was heightened by her personal cleanliness. In the days they spent together, hot, dusty days in the desert of the far west, or in the eastern forests, tramping through pulp mills or fertilizer factories, watching the bulldozers strip the overburden from the coal deposits in billowing clouds of dust, or baking in the depths of the great excavation of the Hani mine, Kitty was always fresh-faced and cool-looking. Even in the dust, her eyes were clear and her small, even teeth sparkled. When or where she had an opportunity to rinse her clothes, he could never decide. But they were always clean and crisp, and her breath, when she leaned close to him, was always sweet. She was a professional. That impressed Shasa also. She would go to any lengths to get the film footage she wanted, taking no account of fatigue or personal danger. He had to forbid her riding on the outside of the mine cage on the Hani main incline shaft to film the drop into the pit. But she went back later, while he was in a meeting with his mine manager, and got exactly the shot she wanted, and then smiled away his fury when he found out. Her crew treated her with an ambivalence that amused Shasa. They held her in fond affection and were immensely protective of her, as though they were her elder brothers, and their pride in her achievements was unconcealed. However, at the same time, they were very much in awe of her ruthless search for excellence, to which they knew she would sacrifice them and anything else that got in her way. Her temper, although not often displayed, was merciless and vitriolic, and when she gave an order, no matter how quietly or how sweet the smile that accompanied it, they jumped. Shasa was also affected by the deep feelings which she had conceived for Africa, its land and its people. "I thought America was the most beautiful country in all the world," she said quietly one evening, as they watched the sunset behind the great desolate mountains of the western deserts. "But when I look at this, I have to wonder." Her curiosity took her into the compounds where the Courtney Company employees were housed, and she spent hours talking to the workers and their wives, filming it all, the questions and answers of black miners and white overseers and shift bosses, their homes and the food they ate, their recreations and their worship. And at the end, Shasa asked her, "So, how do you like the way I oppress them?" "They live well," she conceded. "And they are happy," he pushed her. "Admit it. I hid nothing from you. They are happy." "They are happy like children," she agreed, "as long as they look up to you like Big Daddy. But just how long do you think you can keep fooling them? How long is it going to be before they look at you in your beautiful aeroplane flying back to Parliament to make a few more laws for them to obey and say to themselves, 'Hey, man, I like to try that also.'" For 300 years under white government, the people of this land have woven a social fabric which has held us all together. It works, and I would hate to see it torn asunder without knowing what will replace it. "How about democracy for a start?" she suggested. "That's not a bad thing to replace it with. You know, the will of the majority must prevail." "You left out the best bit," he flashed back at her. "The interests of the minority must be safeguarded. That doesn't work in Africa. The African knows and understands one principle. Winner takes all, and let the minority go to the wall. That's what will happen to the white settlers in Kenya if the British capitulate to the Mau Mau killers." So they wrangled and sparred during the long hours of flying, which took them over the enormous distances of the African continent. From one destination to the next, Shasa and Kitty went ahead in the Mosquito, and the helmet and oxygen mask were too large for her and made her appear even younger and more girlish. David Abrahams piloted the slower and more commodious company De Havilland Dove, the camera equipment and the crew flying with him. And even though most of Shasa's time on the ground was spent in meetings with his managers and administrative staff, there was still much time that he could devote to the seduction of Kitty Godolphin.